From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! We're broadcasting from Denver, Colorado.
Democrats have to be willing to fight for universal health care.
What they're struggling with is they can't afford the health care. And so I emphasize reducing costs.
As Senators Obama and Clinton fight it out over health care, neither proposes single payer. We'll speak with an unusual advocate. He's an evangelical from a conservative background, Dr. Rocky White. Then the Democratic Convention will take place in Denver this August. We'll speak with Recreate 68 about the planned protests and the city's plans for those protests. And finally, we'll look at the life and legacy of Aimé Césaire, poet, writer, politician, and anti-colonial activist from Martinique. He died last Thursday at the age of 94. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Colorado. In Iraq, Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has warned he will soon declare an open war unless the U.S.-backed Iraqi government halts its crackdown on his supporters. Sadr's aide, Nasser al-Rabai, read part of the cleric's message.
I'm giving the last warning and the last word to the Iraqi government. Either it comes to its senses and takes the path of peace, or it will be seen as the same as the previous government. If they don't come to their senses and curb the infiltrated militias, then we will declare an open war until liberation.
Major General Rick Lynch, the commander of U.S. forces in central Iraq, responded by threatening to strike back if Sadr launches a new uprising. The U.S. has already stepped up its attacks on members of Sadr's Mahdi army in Baghdad and Basra. U.S. helicopter gunships and Predator drones have been repeatedly firing missiles into Sadr City. At least 280 Iraqis have died in Sadr City over the past month. The U.S. military is also building a 12-foot-high wall around most of Sadr City. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice made an unannounced stop in Baghdad on Sunday. She praised the Iraqi government's decision to take on Shia militia members in Basra and in Baghdad.
It is indeed a moment of opportunity in Iraq, thanks to the courageous decisions taken by the Prime Minister and a unified Iraqi leadership. And, of course, the Iraqi security forces, which have fought very bravely in this recent operation.
The New York Times has revealed new details on how the Pentagon recruited more than 75 retired military officers to appear on TV outlets as so-called military analysts ahead of the Iraq war to portray Iraq as an urgent threat. The Times reports the Pentagon continues to use the analysts in a propaganda campaign to generate favorable news coverage of the administration's wartime performance. Internal Pentagon documents repeatedly refer to the military analysts as, quote, message force multipliers, or, quote, surrogates, who could be counted on to deliver administration themes and messages to millions of Americans in the form of their own opinions. Reporter David Barstow called the program, quote, a symbiotic relationship where the usual dividing lines between government and journalism have been obliterated. The so-called analysts were given classified Pentagon briefings, provided with Pentagon-approved talking points, and given free trips to Iraq and other sites paid for by the Pentagon. The propaganda campaign also extended into the nation's newspapers. Nine of the Pentagon-connected analysts wrote op-ed articles for the New York Times, and the Pentagon helped two retired military officers write a piece for the Wall Street Journal. Many of the same retired military officers also have ties to military contractors vested in the very war policies they were asked to assess on air. In campaign news, Senators Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton have begun their final full day of campaigning in Pennsylvania ahead of Tuesday's primary. Clinton remains the leader in almost all polls, but on Friday, Obama managed to hold the largest campaign rally of the year when an estimated 35,000 people gathered in Philadelphia. Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter has said Hamas is prepared to accept the right of Israel to live in peace within the 1967 borders. But Carter said Hamas turned down his proposal for a 30-day unilateral ceasefire with Israel. Carter's comments came after he met with top Hamas leaders, including the group's exiled political chief, Khaled Mashal. Carter said Hamas leaders would also accept a peace agreement negotiated by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas if Palestinians approve the deal in a vote. Carter met with Hamas in defiance of the U.S. and Israel. He defended his decision by saying, quote, "The problem is not that I met with Hamas in Syria. The problem is that Israel and the United States refused to meet with someone who must be involved." Carter urged Israel to engage in direct negotiations with Hamas, saying failure to do so was hampering peace efforts. Meanwhile, the Israeli military has announced it'll investigate the death of a Reuters cameraman who was killed last week by an Israeli tank. Human Rights Watch has said the journalist, Fadl Shana, may have been deliberately targeted by an Israeli tank crew. Shana was traveling in a vehicle clearly marked as belonging to media workers when he came under attack. Human Rights Watch's Middle East director, Joe Stork, said, quote, "Israeli soldiers did not make sure they were aiming at a military target before firing, and there is evidence suggesting they actually targeted the journalists." Shana's final piece of footage showed an Israeli tank firing a shell just before the camera went black. Other journalists who arrived at the scene shortly after the shelling also said they came under tank fire. In Paraguay, a former Catholic priest, once known as the Bishop of the Poor, has been elected president. Fernando Lugo will be the first Paraguayan president since 1946 not to be from the conservative Colorado Party. Lugo won 41% of the vote, beating the other candidate who received about 31% of the vote. Lugo has pledged to crack down on corruption and channel Paraguay's wealth into social programs.
May we never again in the political class of Paraguay, never again base our politics on clientism or enticements, because it has done so much damage to our national politics.
Pope Benedict XVI has returned to the Vatican after a six-day trip in the United States. At the United Nations on Friday, Pope Benedict gave a 40-minute address on peace and human rights, but never directly mentioned the Iraq War. In what was viewed as a veiled criticism of the Bush administration, the Pope said nations should obey international law and take collective action to deal with the world's problems. The Pope also said protecting human rights is vital to bridging inequalities between countries.
It is inconceivable, then, that believers should have to suppress a part of themselves, their faith, in order to be active citizens. It should never be necessary to deny God in order to enjoy one's rights.
In Somalia, at least 81 people died over the weekend in the heaviest fighting the capital, Mogadishu, has seen in months. Most of the fighting is between U.S.-backed Ethiopian troops and Somali fighters linked to the former Union of Islamic Courts. The Elman Human Rights Organization accused Ethiopian troops of using heavy artillery and tank shells in residential areas. In other news from Africa, a Chinese ship carrying arms for Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe has been turned away from a dock in South Africa after union workers refused to unload the arms. The dock workers were protesting South African President Thabo Mbeki's failure to pressure Mugabe to release the results of last month's presidential election. The opposition party Movement for Democratic Change claims they won the election, while Mugabe's ruling party says there should be a runoff. On Sunday, Tende Biti, the Secretary General of the MDC, rejected calls for a recount.
It's quite clear that the dictatorship will do everything legally and extra-legally to try and reverse the people's victory of the 29th of March 2008. But we've made our case. The jury's out there. The Zimbabweans themselves know what they did in the polling station. The rest of the African community, the rest of the international community is watching. The so-called recount has no credibility at all, is not legitimate, and we will not accept that recount. We will not accept that which is unlawful.
In economic news, two more major corporations have announced plans to lay off thousands of workers on Friday. Citigroup announced a $5.1 billion loss and said it would cut 9,000 jobs. Meanwhile, AT&T has announced plans to eliminate 4,600 positions. President Bush is heading to New Orleans today to meet with his Mexican and Canadian counterparts for a summit on the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America. Critics of the SPP accuse Bush of pushing a new NAFTA Plus deal with Mexico and Canada that would cover security, immigration, the environment, business, food regulation, and other issues. Amnesty International and other critics accuse the North American leaders of negotiating the deal in secret without meaningful public debate. A legislative panel in Arizona has endorsed a proposal that would prohibit public schools in Arizona from any teachings that overtly encourage dissent from the values of American democracy and Western civilization. The Arizona Republic reports the measure would also prohibit students of the state's universities and community colleges from forming groups based in whole or part on the race of their members, such as the Black Business Students Association at Arizona State University or Native Americans United at Northern Arizona University. Such groups would be forbidden from operating on campus. The sponsor of the bill, Representative Russell Pierce, said he doesn't want taxpayer dollars used to indoctrinate students in what he characterized as anti-American or seditious thinking. Critics say the bill would essentially destroy the Mexican-American study program in the state's public schools, colleges, and universities, as well as student groups such as the Movimiento Estudiantil Chicano de Aztlán. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is warning the surge in global food prices risks setting back the world's anti-poverty efforts, and if not properly handled, could hurt global growth and security. The food price surge has sharply increased the risk of hunger and poverty in developing countries and has already sparked food riots in parts of Asia and Africa. Ban Ki-moon addressed the issue at the opening of a UN trade and development conference in Ghana.
If not handled properly, this crisis could trigger a cascade of others and develop into multiple crises, becoming a multidimensional problem affecting economic growth, social progress, and even political security around the world.
In other food news, a study by the University of Kansas has found genetic modification reduces the productivity of crops. The Independent of London reports the study undermines repeated claims that a switch to controversial technology is needed to solve the growing world food crisis. Researchers found genetically modified soya produces about 10% less food than its conventional equivalent. And prominent pro-Palestinian activists in Texas has died after drowning in a lake. Riyad Hamad was the founder of the Palestine Children's Welfare Fund and raised millions of dollars through his organization for schools, charitable organizations, and hospitals. Local police say Hamad was found gagged and bound in the lake. While police say he likely committed suicide, questions have been raised over his death. Prior to his death, Hamad had been under FBI surveillance. In late February, FBI and IRS agents raided his office and seized 40 boxes of tax returns and other documents. No charges were filed at the time, but investigators claim they had probable cause to investigate wire fraud, bank fraud, and money laundering. Riyad Hamad was 55 years old. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're on the road. Today, we're broadcasting from Denver, Colorado. Tomorrow, it'll be Salt Lake City. And on Wednesday, we'll be broadcasting from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C. Democratic presidential rivals, Senators Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, traded barbs over their health care proposals while campaigning in Pennsylvania this weekend. The rising cost of medical care has emerged as a key concern for voters, particularly as the economy continues to worsen. A new survey by the AFL-CIO found almost all the respondents, most of whom were insured and employed, thought the current health care system is fundamentally broken and plan to vote for ways to change it in November. This is an exchange between Clinton and Obama on health care from their debate in Los Angeles on January 31st that was hosted by CNN.
We cannot get to universal health care, which I believe is both a core democratic value and an imperative for our country, if we don't do one of three things. Either you can have a single payer system, or, which I know a lot of people favor, but for many reasons is difficult to achieve, or you can mandate employers. Well, that's also very controversial. Or you can do what I am proposing, which is to have shared responsibility. Now, in Barack's plan, he very clearly says he will mandate that parents get health insurance for their children. So it's not that he is against mandatory provisions, it's that he doesn't think it would be politically acceptable to require that for everyone. I just disagree with that. I think we as Democrats have to be willing to fight for universal health care.
What they're struggling with is they can't afford the health care. And so I emphasize reducing costs. My belief is that if we make it affordable, if we provide subsidies to those who can't afford it, they will buy it. Senator Clinton has a different approach. She believes that we have to force people who don't have health insurance to buy it. Otherwise, there will be a lot of people who don't get it. I don't see those folks. And I think that it is important for us to recognize that if, in fact, you're going to mandate the purchase of insurance and it's not affordable, then there's going to have to be some enforcement mechanism that the government uses. And they may charge people who already don't have health care fines or have to take it out of their paychecks. And that, I don't think, is helping those without health insurance. That is a genuine difference.
There are important differences between the health care plans offered by the Democratic presidential opponents, but neither of them is proposing a single-payer system of national health care. That's despite the endorsement of precisely such a plan last December by the American College of Physicians, the largest medical specialty organization. The candidate's refusal to consider such a proposal also flies in the face of the latest study indicating a majority of physicians, 59%, now support government legislation to establish national health insurance. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Rocky White. He's a passionate, if unusual, advocate for a single-payer health insurance program. He describes himself as a, quote, evangelical from a conservative background. He's on the board of directors of the nonprofit Healthcare for All Colorado. Most recently, he revised and updated Dr. Robert Lebeau's classic book, Advocating Single-Payer Healthcare. It's called Healthcare Meltdown: Confronting the Myths and Fixing Our Failing System. Dr. Rocky White joins us now here in Denver. He just came up last night from Alamosa, Colorado, where he lives. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. We just drove through on our tour through New Mexico and Colorado, Alamosa, yesterday morning, and we're reminded of the problem with the water. Before we talk about health care, can you talk about what happened to Alamosa's water?
Well, several weeks ago, we started seeing sporadic outbreaks of salmonella in the community, and before too long, those sporadic outbreaks began to grow and grow, and it finally became clear that the salmonella was in the city water system. By the time it was all said and done, we've had about 300, I think I saw in the paper yesterday, 385 cases now of salmonella. And just recently, we had one death. Thankfully, that's all that we've had, but that's basically what happened. We really don't know the source. We don't know where the breach came from. We had a horrible winter. And so it could have been just the freeze-thaw from the exceedingly frozen ground and then probably a breach somewhere with the high sub levels from the amount of snow that we had. I suspect that's probably where it came from, but I'm not sure we'll ever know.
I had heard there was some pipe work that was being done and possibly sewage pipe mixing with the water supply. Is that at all? what could have happened?
There's a lot of theories out there. I'm not sure that we'll ever know for sure. But the city was intending on chlorinating the water at some time in the future, but that future is now. So we now have chlorinated water in Alamosa.
And people are drinking it now.
You know, it was really tough, Amy, for a couple of weeks. People couldn't take baths, couldn't wash their dishes. And, you know, obviously the thing that happened there was the effect on the economy has been devastating. Most of the restaurants had to close down. People got laid off. As a result, then all the businesses downtown, their businesses dropped because the restaurants were closed. And I suspect by the time you think about all the money that's been spent by the city, all the business that's been lost and the tax revenues, it's probably going to cost our community several million dollars by the time it's all said and done.
I also understand, we stopped in at Adams State College, that the first government entity to come in when it was clear there was some kind of salmonella outbreak was the Department of Homeland Security.
Yeah, that is correct. And I think in some respects, well, the Department of Health is sort of tied to that. And I guess in a way, this is sort of a Homeland Security issue, if you would, because the security of the people of Alamosa was in danger. And I think they're trying to kind of tie those two together. That's probably how that happened.
They weren't concerned about Al-Qaeda in Alamosa.
No, we're not concerned about Al-Qaeda in Alamosa. But, you know, the FBI was there. I think in these times and days, I think people are just so paranoid. That's the first thing that comes to their mind.
Well, Dr. Rocky White, I want to talk to you about the healthcare meltdown and about why you are taking on single payer as your key issue. But first, we're going to break, and we're going to break back in New York, live in our studio, Sarah Thompson.
Rulers of the nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying. There are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers crying. They're only pawns in your play of power and corruption. Slowly starve them, your new weapon of mass destruction. And prove to me, America, that you care. You're aware who's dying for your freedom in this land, who pays the cost for the liberties you demand. Is it for freedom or our comfort and convenience? Is it a profit for big business we pledge our allegiance? Are we prisoners?
Sarah Thompson, singing live in our firehouse studio. Is it for freedom? This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Denver, Colorado. Our guest is Dr. Rocky White, an advocate for single-payer health care with an unusual background. Dr. White, why don't you talk about that?
Well, Amy, I grew up in Nebraska, and I came from a very conservative background, an evangelical background. All of my family members, you know, everyone was Republican, very conservative. And when you grow up in that environment, obviously that's just something you just sort of adopt as you get older. After I went through medical school, I intended on going back and practicing medicine in a rural area, and that is eventually what I did. I practiced in western Nebraska for a few years and then ended up in southern Colorado going on 13 years ago down in Alamosa. I joined a for-profit fee-for-service organization down there, and you know, of the 23 physicians that were my partners initially, it was a very conservative group. I mean, this was a fee-for-service group, hardworking. We had one Democrat in the whole group, so that tells you, you know, how where we were at, where we stood politically. But during the 4 or 5 years, well, actually, when I moved to the Valley, there were 11 full-time practicing internal medicine specialists at that time. That's what I do, is practice internal medicine. Just to make a long story short, through the course, as the years went by, as we kind of entered into the new millennium, we started hitting on some very difficult times financially, and eventually we got to the point where we were just about to go broke and we had to join forces with the hospital. Physicians came and went during those 7 or 8 years period of time. In fact, just in our group alone, there were 34 doctors who came and went just in about a 7-year period of time. By the time it was all said and done, when our group finally joined the hospital in 2004, just shortly thereafter, I was the only internal medicine specialist who was practicing full-time in the Valley at that point. So if you go back to the early 90s, as our group started to fall apart financially, I was very good at economics. I was very good at the business of medicine. I knew how to run a business, knew how to hire and fire, balance books, etc. I understood that part of the business of medicine, but I didn't understand the bigger picture, and that is the policies that got us to where we're at today. And as we started to fall apart, I started to study that and try to understand what is so wrong with our group, or not just our group, but I began to see it was just the whole healthcare system as a whole, not just our group. And as I began to study and to look at state policy and federal policy and going back, if you want to understand our healthcare system, you have to go back 50 or 100 years to see how we evolved into this. You know, there wasn't some mad scientist in the 1940s who devised this horrible system that we have today. It was just a matter of evolutionary process, so to speak. But as I began to study that and to try and assimilate what it was that was going on, I began to see some very disturbing trends. The part of the reasons that we got to where we're at today are multiple. There's not just one, this is what happened. And as I started to weave that together, I began to say, Jiminy Christmas, this thing is really screwed up. And now I'm beginning to understand the healthcare system very well, not just our group, but as a whole. And then I began to ask myself, what are we going to have to do to fix it? And so, obviously, single payer was not even something that I would have even considered 10 years ago. In fact, 10 years ago, I didn't even know the word single payer existed. And so, as I started to look at that, and I looked at different ways that we could fix this whole thing, I mean, you talk about subsidies, expanding Medicaid, all of that, I began to realize that the only way that we're going to fix this system is we're going to have to put everyone on a Medicare-like system. In order to truly fix the system, we're going to have to put everyone into one single risk pool. We're going to have to share that risk, and the most efficient way to do that is through the tax system. At that time, I didn't know anything about Physicians for a National Health Program. I never heard of Bob Lebow. In fact, the word single payer, I hadn't even heard that, you know, back in the late 90s. And so as I started to put all this together, I said, you know, I'm going to write a book about this. This is so important to do this. And so one day I was down at the emergency room, and one of my colleagues, who's sort of an old hippie from the 60s, a very liberal individual, she knew how conservative I was because at that time I was still a Republican. And I was very sheepish about the whole thing. I mean, here I am, a Republican, thinking about nationalizing health care. It just went against the grain of everything that I stood for. But you have to remember something, Amy. I didn't come to those conclusions with lofty ideals of social justice. It was purely from an economic standpoint. This is the only way that we're going to be able to fix this and do it efficiently. So as I started to talk to Beth, she said, Rocky, have you ever heard of a group called Physicians for a National Health Program? And I said, no. And so she gave me the web page, and I got on. And as I started looking at reading the information that had been written by Steffi Woolhandler and Dave Himmelstein, I think you've talked to them before, looking at Bob's book and things, I thought, criminelli, these people are thinking like I'm thinking. This is, you know, I thought I was this crazy person out in the middle of the middle of nowhere coming up with this idea. And so that spring there was a conference in Chicago that Ida Hellinger was putting on with training people to be advocates for single payer. And so when I went out there, she introduced me to this book, Healthcare Meltdown, that was written by Bob Lebeau. And as I started going through it, it was sort of one of those Twilight Zone experiences, I guess, because it was really strange, because he had written my book. He had, I mean, even the chapters were very similar. And so, and I guess it's not surprising, because when you start coming to these conclusions, you start thinking in the same lines. So I thought, you know, I'm not going to write my book. Bob Lebeau already did this. I'm just going to get out there and start being an advocate and start speaking.
And Bob Lebeau was president of Physicians for a National Health Program, ultimately was paralyzed in a cycling accident and died about 5 years ago.
Yeah, that's correct.
So you wrote the introduction to the new edition of Healthcare Meltdown, Confronting the Myths and Fixing Our Failing System.
Yeah, because that's what's so strange about that, is because I was up speaking in Idaho and got to meet his wife. And to make a long story short, Ida got a hold of Mrs. Lebeau, Gail, and the two of them said, you know, we'd really like to have Rocky write this, because my background is so similar to Bob's. In fact, Bob was a Republican and changed to a Democrat at about the same age that I did that. And Bob practiced rural medicine. He practiced to the underserved areas. He was very passionate about the uninsured, very similar to myself. And so it was quite an honor when they called me and said, would you revise this and update this for the second edition? And so I did. I put an introduction in there. I updated all the numbers, brought it all up to date, and then added two chapters to the book.
When you hear, for example, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton debating health care, what are your thoughts, and explain what single payer is?
Well, single payer can be a lot of things, but basically what single payer means is that you have one organization that handles the financing of health care. That one organization could be a for-profit insurance company if you only had one. It could be the government. It could be a public utility commission. So that's all single payer means. The thing is, you know, you and I grew up in the same era. We have this idea about single payer and socialized medicine sort of locked together. When I say the word single payer, the first thing that comes into people's minds is, oh my God, social medicine, we get socialized medicine, and the next thing that's going to happen is that the hammer and sickle is going to start flying from the top of the Capitol. And so when I explain to people that there are a lot of different types of single-payer systems, you can have purely socialized medicine. That's kind of like what England has. The government owns the hospitals. The government owns the clinics. The government finances all the health care, and all the doctors work for the government. That is truly socialized medicine, as opposed to the Canadian system, where the financing comes through their Medicare program, but all the doctors are in private practice. And so that's kind of the spectrum, so to speak.
And when you hear the candidates debating health care, do you think that they really do differ? And why do you think they don't go with, as Hillary Clinton started the beginning, we heard the clip where she was talking about the options. She started by saying, well, single payer is an option. Many people cheered in the audience, and she went on to say that wasn't likely.
Yeah. Well, I think that part of the problem is that our current health care system is so entrenched with the system that we have. We have this plurality of systems where we actually have a single-payer system, which is Medicare. We have another single-payer system for Medicaid for the poor. And then we've got private insurance, which is a speckling of all kinds of crazy things. You know, this industry is a $2 trillion industry, and the profits in the for-profit insurance industry are so huge that, and it's so deeply entrenched into Wall Street, that this country's going to have a hard time extracting that. And I think that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton understand that, and they don't want to go ripping up this system for the sake of an ideal. But the fact of the matter is until we move to a single-payer system and get rid of the profit motive in financing of healthcare, we will not be able to fix the problems that we have. They will be impossible to fix.
What do you think is the single biggest misunderstanding about single-payer in this country, and what is your strategy for having it adopted? What do the polls in the United States show of how Americans feel?
You know, it's interesting. As you see the polls, as you've seen them move through from about 1999 up to the present, you're seeing an ever-increasing number of people starting to support a national health program. And in fact, there was a recent poll that came back from one of the medical associations back east and was just published in JAMA a couple of weeks ago.
The Journal of the American Medical Association.
The Journal of the American Medical Association, which shows that 59% of practicing physicians today believe that we need to have a national health program. I mean, that's unheard of even 10 years ago.
I mean, they were the biggest group opposed because of the finances.
Oh, I mean, that's it. I mean, you know, physicians traditionally have been the group that has been the anchor sunk into the mud that has been dragging this whole healthcare reform process along. In fact, the AMA, the American Medical Association, launched a huge effort back in the 1960s to stop Medicaid and Medicare. And so it's amazing to see a new generation of physicians coming up who are disgusted with our current healthcare system. You know, we're trained to be advocates of patients. We're trained to save lives. We're trained to practice medicine. And instead, what we're doing is we're practicing Wall Street economics. And they're two diametrically opposed.
So how do you inject this idea into the presidential debate?
What it's going to take is it's going to take pressure from the bottom up. You know, I think that our current presidential candidates, I think both of them understand that ideally single payer would be the best, but they don't have the political will to move that forward. And so it's going to take, I use it for this example. I said, you know, as the governor of the state of Colorado or the president of the United States, their job is to feel which way the wind is blowing. Our job is to turn that wind. And that happens by me coming down and speaking to you this morning. I go out and talk to Kiwanis groups and Rotary groups. And especially the thing that I've been doing is going around and speaking with my fellow physicians, because it's surprising how many doctors don't even understand the system. I'll have to admit that 8 years ago, I didn't understand the system. And I think once people understand the system and understand what's wrong with it, they're going to do the same thing that I did.
The American College of Physicians has endorsed. This is your association.
That's my association of internal medicines. American College of Physicians, they gave a dual support, so to speak. They said, if we're going to fix the system, we either have to do this or this. And surprisingly, one of those was a single-payer system.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. This is the beginning of a more extended conversation. C. Rocky White has been our guest. He has revised and updated the book by Robert Lubow, Healthcare Meltdown, Confronting the Myths and Fixing Our Failing System. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting from KBDI, public broadcasting here in Denver. We'll be back in a minute.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
When it's looking dark and gloomy and you need a little cheer, some other crook or crony telling lies and spreading fear, hatch a clever joke and just bedevil the do-batters, raise some hell, raise some kick-ass kitchen clatter. Soup pot, stew pot, souffle pan, grab a wooden spoon and start a stirring up a plan. That's all yours truly, Molly Ivins. Stop the war, get in the street and start jiving. Come on, people, would you raise a little hell? You know things are not going so well. If you don't make a noise, no one's gonna hear a sound. We are the people who will turn this place around. All right. She said there's something about politics I came to preach today, and I'm very, very serious about what I'm gonna say. Y'all need to have more fun and celebration, and to do it you just have to exercise imagination. Lord, Lord, let your laughter ring forth deep down in the South, way up in the North. Beloveds, be-eyed, outrageous freedom fighters, we are the people, we are the deciders.
The Ballad of Molly Ivins here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Denver, Colorado, from the PBS station KBDI, where Democracy Now! Broadcasts here in Denver. Yes, Denver will play host to the Democratic National Convention this August, and preparations are well underway for the big event. It remains to be seen whether the Democrats will ultimately take their fight for a presidential candidate all the way to the convention. But for many activists tired of the two-party system and the ongoing war, they will be demonstrating at the convention, regardless of who the final nominee is. As Denver readies to sign contracts with dozens of security agencies ahead of the convention, we look at some of the concerns around the rights of the protesters and how lawyers and activists are preparing to protect demonstrators. Mark Silverstein is on the phone with us, legal director of the ACLU in Colorado. We're also joined in the studio at KBDI by Mark Cohen. He's an organizer with Recreate 68, a group of activists attempting to greet this year's Democratic National Convention with the same demands of accountability and ending the war that animated protesters in Chicago 40 years ago. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Mark Cohen, what are your plans for this convention?
Thank you, Amy. We plan to have a massive presence during the Democratic National Convention in August. We will be having a number of major demonstrations, including on the Sunday, the day before the convention begins, what will probably be the biggest anti-war march and rally that Denver has seen, at least since Vietnam. We're also working with some of the major immigrant rights groups to, on the Tuesday, have what we think will be a very large immigrant rights march and rally. But we're not only involved in protest activities. We're also staging what we're calling the Festival of Democracy, which will be a five-day event in downtown Denver, during which we'll have trainings, workshops, teach-ins, and provide people the opportunity to come together and learn about alternatives to the two-party system, solutions that communities can provide to their own problems. We're also, during that, going to have a 24/7 free health clinic, legal services, two feedings a day in cooperation with Food Not Bombs and other services for the community.
Mm-hmm. And who is we?
We are Recreate 68, which is a group of local Denver activists. We began planning for the Democratic National Convention, actually before we found out that Denver had been given the convention. It looked like a fairly certain thing. So we've been planning for about a year and a half now. We've been talking with the city to try to ensure that people's First Amendment rights would be protected during the convention. We've been working with national organizations, among them United for Peace and Justice, Code Pink, and others, as well as numerous Colorado organizations to prepare for this event, to try to use the attention and the excitement and the energy generated by this major event to kind of kick organizing in Denver up to another level.
Mark Silverstein, you're legal director of the Colorado ACLU. What are the city's plans for these protests?
Well, you're asking me to tell you the city's plans, and unfortunately, the city has not responded to some of our requests for information about those plans. I can tell you that political conventions like this have historically been marked by struggles over law enforcement's attempt to balance interest in security with the First Amendment rights of the public and protesters. In the past, that balance has sometimes been subjected to judicial review, and courts have disagreed with law enforcement about the proper balance. Since 9/11, I think the issues have even gotten more intense. We know in Boston in 2004, the city provided what it called a demonstration zone outside of the convention that the district court said was like a concentration camp and an affront to the First Amendment. But there wasn't enough time for the court to fully evaluate it and issue an order that would remedy the problems. We have been trying to find out what it will look like, what kind of regulations will apply to First Amendment activity near the site of the convention. And so far, Denver has been either unwilling or unable to discuss any of that in detail, pointing to the Secret Service as the ultimate shot caller for security at the convention. And the Secret Service has said, well, it won't have details to reveal to the public until sometime this summer, maybe as late as August. And, of course, that might be far too late to have any negotiation over the arrangements for First Amendment activity, and certainly too late for an opportunity for judicial review. So that's very much a concern for us.
I'm looking at a piece just recently in the Denver Post, No Cages for DNC Protesters, that according to Denver City Councilman Charlie Brown, protesters will not be confined to cages during the Democratic National Convention. The city wants to get away from the long lines of shoulder-to-shoulder riot gear-clad police that typified security, saying we don't want to provoke violence, Mark.
And that's a very commendable sentiment. And, at the ACLU, we certainly hope that what Councilman Brown says will indeed be the reality. But, you know, there's a question that I always ask when somebody in government makes an assurance like that. I ask, well, how do they know? Because when we've talked with the city officials or when we've read what's quoted in the newspaper, the answer always is, well, we don't know yet because the Secret Service ultimately makes the decision, and the Secret Service isn't saying, at least publicly. So there's a rumor that there's going to be a one-mile radius hard security perimeter around the convention site. And then you can occasionally read in the paper somebody will debunk that as a rumor. It's not true that there will be a one-mile security zone around the convention. But yet, when you talk to the city people who ought to know, they say, well, we don't know yet. And if they don't know, then how do they know there won't be a one-mile security radius? There must be some plans already formulated.
Protesters a mile away from the Pepsi Center, that's where the Democratic Convention is going to be?
That's correct. That's correct.
According to Colorado Confidential, a web publication, the Denver Police Department is using taxpayer money to buy new security equipment in preparation for the DNC, but is refusing to disclose exactly what the purchases are, saying that revealing the information would be contrary to the public interest. Mark Cohen, what do you know about that?
We do know that the city council has allocated $5 million for new weapons for the Denver Police Department. We know that in St. Paul, they've issued tasers to every single officer on the force. We're aware that there are new weapons out there that are being ostensibly used for crowd control in places like Iraq, but we've seen report on 60 Minutes, for example, where they were doing field tests with these weapons, and the people they were testing on were dressed as protesters and carrying protest-type signs. So we have a feeling that the field tests for these new weapons are going to be at the Democratic National Convention and possibly the Republican Convention as well. So the weapons that are being designed primarily for military use are going to be used on peaceful, nonviolent protesters.
One of the things that we've seen at the conventions past is the level of infiltration by police and also surveillance. Now, Mark Cohen, you were a plaintiff in the Denver Spy Files
yes.
case. Explain what that was.
We discovered in, I believe it was 2001, that the, or maybe earlier than that, but we discovered that the Denver Police Department had been keeping what they called criminal intelligence files on people who had engaged in no criminal activity but simply exercised their First Amendment rights in protests and demonstrations. There were labels on these files such as criminal extremist, and the information in these files was, first of all, not the kind of information that had any relationship to criminal activity. People had written letters to the editors of the local papers, and they had stuck these in files, and they also had a good deal of false information. My wife, who's a middle-aged Jewish woman, was identified as belonging to a white racist motorcycle gang that dealt in drugs and weapons. So we were obviously very concerned about this, especially because we discovered that these files were being shared with other law enforcement agencies. And in the atmosphere after 9/11, this is a very dangerous thing to be identified as a criminal extremist and as presumably a security threat. So we did sue the city and got out of the suit a change in policy which prevents the Denver Police Department from collecting intelligence information on people who are not actually engaged in criminal activity.
Well, we are going to leave it there for now, but certainly we'll continue to follow this. Mark Cohen with us from Recreate 68, and Mark Silverstein on the line with us, legal director of the Colorado ACLU. I want to thank you both for being with us. As we wrap up now with the death of Aimé Césaire, the esteemed poet, writer, politician, and anti-colonial activist from Martinique, who died last Thursday at 94 years old. He is revered in the Francophone world as a leading figure in the movement of black consciousness and pride, which he called negritude. Césaire was also a politician for a large part of his life. The Caribbean island of Martinique is administratively and politically a region of France, and its residents are French citizens. Césaire served as the mayor of Martinique's capital and the elected representative to the French Constituent Assembly for close to half a century. French President Nicolas Sarkozy led thousands of mourners at an official state funeral Sunday for Césaire in Martinique. But in 2005, Césaire had refused to meet Sarkozy because of a new law Sarkozy had proposed emphasizing the positive legacy of French colonialism. Césaire's use of culture to fight colonialism and racism influenced generations of activists and writers around the world. Fellow Martinican author and revolutionary Frantz Fanon considered Césaire to be his mentor. Today, we'll speak with Professor Robin Kelly about the life and legacy of Aimé Césaire. Kelly is professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California and the author of several books, including Freedom Dreams, The Black Radical Imagination. He also wrote the introduction to a new edition of Césaire's famous 1955 essay called Discourse on Colonialism. Professor Kelly joins us now from our Firehouse studio in New York. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Kelly.
Oh, thank you, Amy.
Tell us who Aimé Césaire was.
Well, Césaire, among other things, was probably one of the greatest poets of the 20th century. He was an activist, revolutionary, who really demolished the maxim that poets make bad politicians. He's someone who, throughout his life, of course, you mentioned he was one of the founders, if not the founder, of the Negritude movement beginning in 1935 when he wrote an essay coining that phrase. On the one hand, negritude for him was a recognition that Africa had value, and he'd been reading Leo Frobenius's book, History of African Civilization. But for him, you know, Africa having value and celebrating black pride wasn't enough. He had a forward-looking vision, a post-colonial vision, and when he returned to Martinique with his wife, Suzanne Césaire, who's one of the greatest intellectuals of that era as well. They edited a journal called Tropique, which was a truly anti-colonial manifesto in some ways that combines surrealism, Pan-Africanism, and Marxism pretty much propose a very modernist vision of society that would transcend Europe. And you remember what happened after the end of World War II? Europe was in shambles philosophically, politically, and it was Césaire, when he wrote Discourse on Colonialism, that kind of made the argument that, you know, the brutality and barbarism that defined colonialism came back to roost in some ways and can explain fascism in Europe. And if any group of people have the wherewithal or vision to recreate modern society, it is colonial peoples.
And can you talk about this clash he had with Sarkozy several years ago?
Well, you know, it's part of, I think, a longstanding argument that Césaire made in particularly Discourse on Colonialism. There is a way in which, you know, the French colonial legacy gets defined as a civilizing mission particularly since you had Africans and Afro-Caribbean people serving in the National Assembly. And Césaire himself was one who, as a member of the Communist Party, was a deputy to the French National Assembly. And the argument is that, well, French colonialism is different. It's one that wasn't based on brutality or violence, but based on assimilation. And Césaire rejected that. And by the time he's writing in the 1960s, he had completely rejected any value of that kind of colonial relationship or the metropolitan peripheral relationship that defined, again, the Francophone world. And so in terms of his disagreements, it fits within his larger, I think, political vision, and that is that there's really nothing good about colonialism. You know, there's nothing that you could salvage from its legacy. And in fact, on the contrary, we have to go back and revisit colonialism to understand the direction of the West and the failure of the Enlightenment in some ways. You know, here's Césaire, who's a real committed advocate of the Enlightenment, who had come to realize that racism ultimately defined modern society of the West. And that was one of his biggest issues. And I think I have to give it to Sarkozy for even recognizing the importance of Césaire. It's sort of like, imagine if George Bush were to recognize the importance of an Ossie Davis, for example. That's kind of unheard of.
Can you talk about his influence on the anti-colonial struggles of the 50s and 60s?
Well, absolutely. He was probably one of the most important intellectuals. He was a founding editor of President's African, which was a journal which advocated independence, but also promoted black, not just French, but across the board, the African diasporic, art, poetry, music, and political essays. He was also part of a wave of writers who, in the 1940s and 50s, had argued that, the future of the world depended on the Third World. In other words, the Third World was the vanguard. The Third World was the modern force that could civilize Europe. And one of his central theses in Discourse on Colonialism was that when you look at the impact colonialism had on the modern world, we always look at the impact on the colonized. But he says, let's look at the impact on the colonizer. Colonialism decivilized the West. It revealed its underlying barbarity. And on the other hand, the cultures of Africa and indigenous peoples and even Asia he argues, represented anti-capitalism. In other words, anti meaning A-N-T-E before capitalism, and anti meaning opposition to capitalism. And that, in fact, these...
Professor Kelly, we're going to have to leave it there,
okay.
But I thank you very much for joining
us.
Professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California. That does it for our broadcast. We're broadcasting from KBDI. A special thank you to this PBS station in Denver and to Sarah Thompson, who sang in our Firehouse studio. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.